My name is Dave Hanratty, and there will be no encore. Welcome to episode 330, everybody. Wow, Jesus, that's a scary thing. And it's an encore podcast. It's a music podcast. I'm joined this week not by Craig Fitzpatrick for reasons that we will get into, but you've probably figured it out already. However, Adam, I've got a hell of a guy for this episode.
Sure do.
Would you believe?
Yeah, you sure do.
I sure do. That's Adam Shanahan, everybody. Sonic Architect Adam. I'm delighted to do this. I'm delighted to welcome back to the show. I don't know if we've co-hosted together before. You have previously co-hosted with Craig. We did an episode with you as well, of course. All the way from the University of Limerick, it's Royal Yellow, a.k.a. Mark O'Brien, formerly of Enemies, now of Royal Yellow. How the hell are you, sir?
Yo. It's good to be back. Coming to you live from the mean streets of Limerick. Pleasure, guys. There is currently a man who has just decided to start hoovering outside my office door. So if you're picking up any ambient hoovering frequencies, that's what's going on there. We were joking earlier about how, like, I always seem to have a fan issue going on, like a laptop fan or a ceiling fan, when I've done the podcast in the past. And I went through great lengths to eliminate that possibility, and now we have a fucking Hoover. So there's always going to be air moving, it seems, when I open my mouth. But yeah, it's great to be back, Hoovers or not. I think he's going to be gone soon. It's lovely to be back, guys. Thanks for having me. What can I say?
Well, thank you, man. Thank you for you said lots there. Thank you for stepping up in our hour of need, because unfortunately the rumors are true, everybody. Or if you're a subscriber to the No Encore Patreon.com/No Encore, you would of course gotten the news earlier this week in the episode preview that unfortunately Craig Fitzpatrick, we teased it on the show last week, guys. We said, I hope he doesn't get COVID. He got COVID. Ouch. He's negative now. I chatted to him today, but he was in such a bad way on like Monday morning that we were just like, you can't do the show this week. You're fucked. And he, like, honestly, he came home like you got to feel so sorry for the boy. Three years Jesus. Holding on to those tickets, primarily to see the Strokes. He gets there, they cancel, and then he comes home and gets COVID the next day. So, Jesus Christ.
I mean, I saw Craig at Primavera. I was there too. And, I mean, who's to say that I didn't slip a little something into that Jack Daniels that I bought him around 1 a.m. on the Saturday. All part of my master plan to get back in the No Encore co-host seat.
It's incredible. Sorry, look, this is a man here admitting to international bioterrorism. Yeah. Like he's in fucking Resident Evil. Not a good look, Mark. I'm going to be
chance,
honest with you.
Dave, I saw my chance and I took it.
Yeah, well, in fairness, you know.
Wouldn't do the same.
For the privilege of co-hosting the show. Yeah. We send our best wishes to Craig. Absolutely. He genuinely was in a heap, honestly. And listen, the thing about Craig is, like, he's not the kind of guy to, like, just, like, take sick, take off work. He usually actually puts way too much stress on himself to always be working, and especially with the show as well. So it's a rare situation when he turns around and says, you know, I don't think I should do this. So I was like, all good, man. Don't worry about it. No problem. Yeah. On this show, though, like I say, we've got a Royal Yellow. We've got a top five, and we're going to be doing top five movie opening credits music, which I thought we had done, but it turns out we haven't. We've done horror movie themes, we've done end credits movie music, we've done all kinds of, we've done TV show theme tunes, there's definitely more, but I don't think we've done, you know, here's the opening credits of a movie, here's music associated with it. It's inspired by Top Gun Maverick, a film I have now seen twice in the cinema.
Amazing. Catching up with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood there.
Well, that's on 8. I don't know if Top Gun Maverick is going to get to 8, but we can all agree that box office smash, underdog sensation Top Gun Maverick is in fact great.
Yes.
And Mark, this was your shout, Mark. So what rationale beyond I enjoyed Top Gun Maverick did you bring to this suggestion?
Yeah, well, I'm actually, a lot has changed since last time I was on the podcast, and I will find a way to tie this into the top five, don't you worry. But I'm now living in Limerick, in beautiful Limerick City. I'm doing a master's in the University of Limerick in art and technology, and I'm writing my thesis at the moment on cinema. So I've been going to the cinema a lot. It's basically, I'm writing about the disappearance of cinemas from town centres, and how now cinemas exist in retail parks outside of communities, essentially, and they're kind of strapped on to this shopping center experience, which is unfortunate, but it's throwing up a lot of interesting. I'm just like watching a lot of movies, going to visiting different cinemas around the country, and just very immersed in the world of the film. So yeah, I took myself to Killarney actually to see Top Gun Maverick, and yeah, it was there where, as I heard the triumphant cocaine saturated notes of Highway to the Danger Zone by Kenny Loggins that I thought this would be a great top five. So here we are. I'm really excited about it. I had a lot of fun picking these out. I'm looking forward to it. There were a few that I questioned. We'll get into it. Problematic or not, there's some humdingers in there.
Excellent.
How did you find it, Dave?
I really enjoyed it, and it's yet another example of one that we could do 10 times over. I expect we will do a sequel to this, because how do you pick just five? And the five I've picked were the five that kind of made, you know, they made the strongest case for me within the time frame of putting this together. I think I've got a killer top five. I'm very happy with it. Nice. But can I just say, by the way,
I have a strong suspicion I'm going to know one of them.
Okay, well, let's hold off until we get to the top five.
We'll get into it.
Because of course, again, if you're a new listener for the very first time, maybe you're a friend of Mark's and you're like, I better check out this rubbish podcast he's on. Turns out, actually, you're wrong, listener. It's a great podcast. But here's the thing. The gimmick of the top five is that I don't know what Mark's picked. He doesn't know what I've picked. Only Adam Shanahan holds the knowledge and indeed the relevant audio clips. So that's coming later in the show. No album review this week because, again, super tight for time. The week that's in it, again, Mark has stepped up to the plate. Thank you very much for doing so. One thing, though, I have to say, that sounds like a fucking incredible thesis. Where do I sign up?
Yeah, it's that was kind of the jumping off point, and I have to create like a series of artworks, you know, it being a practical art-based master's. So it is morphing into a lot of like experimental video pieces that are sort of themed around nostalgia and hauntology, which is this idea that we are continuously haunted by the memories and the ghosts of our past. So there's a lot of really cool stuff popping up, and I'm actually really enjoying it. So I will possibly find a way to work this all into some sort of upcoming Royal Yellow work. I haven't quite got that far yet, but there is definitely sounds being created as part of it, as well as video, and there's going to be an exhibition later in the summer at some point. I'm trying to get a disused cinema space here in Limerick to potentially do it as a kind of a site-specific thing. So yeah, it's nice. I'm feeling very switched on. Where do you sign up?
Send me envelopes
of cash.
I genuinely want to pivot this podcast into this entire subject matter. This is firing all the synapses in my brain. But if you want to send envelopes of cash anywhere, listener, it is, of course, patreon.com/noencore. Adam Shanahan is clapping in the background.
He's doing it again every week.
Independent podcast. We could use all the help we can get. It helps keep the lights on the show. There is some bonus content, of course. There are episodes up there. You know, our monthly recommends corner, a couple of Q&A episodes, episode previews, this playlist, etc. As always stressed, you know, independent podcast. We do what we can extra where possible. We push it to the limit. Maverick from Top Gun style. And we appreciate all the support that we've had to date and continue to have. Thank you so much to everyone who does pay on Patreon and get involved there. And of course, anyone who just listens to the show, like we say every week, please tell someone about the show. Always good to have new listeners. And I guess before we move on to the news section, let's talk Primavera, because you were there. So yeah. How was it for you?
Oh, it was a whirlwind. It was a whirlwind. So let's get the horrific part out of the way first, shall we? I know you spoke a little bit about this on the podcast last week. I think listeners will probably be no stranger to the
bumping into Craig on a night out. Yeah, I know. Like, it can go either way. Yeah, let's be honest.
Just,
you know,
an absolute disaster. I mean, when did he start spiking people? It was so weird.
I don't know.
Yeah, so like we got in. Like, look, this is my fourth time going to Primavera, and so we have a crew that we kind of go with every year. And so the bright-eyed, bushy-tailed kind of like, we're getting in at like 4 o'clock in the day, and we're staying until 7 in the morning. Those days are long gone. We we look at it now as a marathon rather than a sprint. And so what we typically do is, like, we'll go for a nice dinner, we'll, like, hang out on the beach during the day, we will just do things that are not connected to Primavera, and then we might wander in around 8 o'clock at night and just go at it. So that was exactly what we did on the first day. Probably about 9 or 9:30 by the time we finally left our jars of sangria and fell down La Ramblas in the direction of Parc del Forum. Only to be like inundated with messages from friends that were already there about how this was like fire festival reincarnated, that like toilet queues were like an hour long, that people couldn't get a drink, that they had run out of water, that it was just incredibly oversold to the point of being like potentially being like a health and safety hazard. So that scared the fucking Jesus out of us. We got into a cab anyway. We headed down. We figured we'd go and take our chances. Got out of the cab only to discover that friend of the show, Lewis Jackson, former bandmate of mine from Enemies, his phone was just gone. So our mind immediately raced to that, like, Barcelona being kind of an infamous city for pickpocketing, and someone had just lifted it out of his tote bag. We went to the ticket desk, big long queue for like problems like that, because his ticket is on his phone. So
For
a while, you know, eventually got served by like a volunteer staff member who was clearly like out of her mind high on something, and was just like asking us where we were from in Ireland and telling us about the times she visited Ireland and all the crack she had in Dalkey. So we're just like trying to get in. She can't figure out the system at all. Her supervisor has to keep coming over. Eventually we get in and it's like it's fucking rammed, and we know that like anywhere in the vicinity of like the main stage is just going to be hell. So having been there in previous years, there's a stage down the back that generally houses like death metal, and like your pals, the Armed, were playing down there.
My boys.
Yeah. And I also later in the weekend would see like Napalm Death and Lightning Bolt down there. So we were like, let's go down there, because that's not going to be, the Armed is not going to be like more packed than Charlie XCX. So we went down there. It was actually grand. The queues were fine. We were able to get a drink. We were able to, you know, settle in and sort of just like get our bearings. I had this like horrible, horrible anxious feeling in my stomach of just like in that Woodstock 99 documentary where people just start talking about like when Limp Bizkit came on and it just changed. Fortunately, it actually, post Charlie XCX, post Tame Impala, hordes and hordes and hordes of people who had come in to see those bands started leaving, and it actually started to become like a manageable festival experience. We wandered over to Pavement, and that was just an incredible turning point. Like, Pavement were absolutely incredible. There was this incredible joy in the air. The band seemed to be having the best time ever. I feel like I'm lingering way too long on. I've only gotten to like band number one, but yeah.
No. Listen, I mean, Craig isn't here, man. You know, like his report is 2 weeks overdue at this stage. Come on. Man,
well, I spoke to Crave about this. Crave.
it's Metal Craig.
When Craig is at Pavement, we call him Cravement. But yeah, we spoke about it. We both had a wonderful time at that. That was a real turning point on night one, which was looking like it was going to be an absolute disaster. Fast forward then, a couple of beers later, I'm at Black Midi, a band who I have never, ever cared for in the slightest. Loved the review episode on their last album, Medieval
Tavern yeah.
Owner. So wandered over. My mates wanted to see them. I had no interest. I find it's just difficult music to listen to. Had the fucking time of my life. Loved it. Was exactly what I needed. Like, totally cathartic after the stress and the anxiety of like the uncertainty of the first half of the night. They came out swing dancing with each other to like some old swing song, and then just launched into like this hour of just like 300 miles an hour insanity. It was genuinely mind-blowing. It was one of the best like drum performances I've ever seen in my life. Their drummer deserves a fucking Nobel Prize. And I absolutely loved it and was converted and will still never listen to them because it's just not what I want to listen to when I'm going about my day. But live, it was a totally, totally different beast, and I absolutely loved it. Okay, so I'm just going to cut now to other like notable acts during the weekend. Low were amazing. DJ Shadow was absolutely incredible. Caroline Polachek doing a Coors cover of Breathless.
Yeah.
Fucking like otherworldly. Lightning Bolt were amazing. Napalm Death were great. Beach House was just an absolute living dream. I actually went to see Beach House in Dublin 2 weeks before. Ate a really strong weed jelly. Had the worst night of my life. So it was wonderful to be able to go and see them again and have a really good time. So yeah, there you go.
Incredible. What a cogent report. I love it. Yeah. I have to, Adam, you go
first.
Yeah,
I just want to quickly say, I think that's already made like the top moments of the year 2022. Like that whole monologue was just fantastic. Thank you very much.
Beautiful. Cravement. Oh my God. Well, speaking of Cravement, I have to ask, at what point did he surface? Had you pre-arranged meeting up with Craig? Did he appear like a mirage out of nowhere? I need to know how this went down.
It was like, I had this going with about four friends who were at Primavera, like where it's just like you're constantly on WhatsApp going like, hey man, are you going to check out Caribou? And it's like, yeah, we'll be front left. And then you get there and there's like 80,000 people and they're like, hold up your phone, bro. Like this was just constant. I was in a group with 30 people from Limerick and this was just constant. So there was a whole like 36 hours of like attempting to meet up with Craig before we actually finally found each other, which was post Caribou, I think on the Saturday, on the second night, the Friday night.
I'm picturing just two handsome boys running across the concourse and hugging.
Man,
that's what I'm picturing.
Singing Can't Do Without You, just hollering it out to each other. It was great. He was very chill, as Craig always is. He's just like, hey man. And we went, it was like, you know, pretty late at this point. His sister had gone home. So we took him under our wing. We got him a couple of whiskeys, spiked him with COVID. And I don't know, probably talked about The Simpsons a lot and yeah, I actually kind of, we just went deep into like nerding out then at that point.
Yeah,
it was just
talked
was
about
just
how me, amazing right? amazing Dave Hanratty is. Yeah, I assume that was the of crux of the conversation.
Clocked in about 30,000 steps from the point of where I met Craig to the end of the night. It is a massive, massive festival. It's very, very,
it's an experience
to get the steps
hanging
in.
Out with Craig is an experience.
It was great.
Craig
will be, it was great seeing him.
Craig will be back next week, I promise, listener. If not, I'll suspend him from the show if he doesn't return next week, okay? Oh, yeah.
That just means he's gone for another week.
Is he not in Sheffield checking out the Strokes or something?
He's going to Glasgow to check out the Strokes pretty soon. That's all ahead of us, as is most of the show. I realise we've been talking for quite some time, but it's, you know, you've been on for a while. And I say one last piece of business before we move on real quick. It's been about a year, right, since the release of the Magnificent Still Until EP, Boy Royal Yellow.
Thank you.
So go check that out if you haven't checked it out, listener. And also, real quick, I know you're very busy going to the movies all the time, but new music coming soon, maybe, possibly, hopefully?
I mean, unless this thesis project somehow turns into a concept album, which is a possibility. But I have been like very much just buried in like making sonic art, like not making music in the traditional sense, but making sort of works as part of a weird artistic academic endeavor. So some of it will probably end up being something. And look, my last release was like 12 minute long song, so it can't be any more up its own hole than that. So yeah, that's what we can look forward to.
A great 12 minute long song. Well, listen, we go from sonic art to our sonic architect. Adam, it's time for the news section, but could you kick things off a little differently, please? I prepared a clip for our lead news story. It's a sad story, but let's pay great respect to a great singer. So, that is Falling, the song by Julie Cruz and Twin Peaks composer Angelo Badalamenti. Julie Cruz passed away last week. The news only broke on Friday after the show had already come out. And obviously, you know, if you listen to Noir, you know how much we are obsessed with Twin Peaks and the world of David Lynch, of which Julie Cruz was a huge part of. She was 65 years of age. She'd been ill for a number of years. In the end, she died by suicide. It's a very sad story. Her husband confirmed the news and said she's left this world on her own terms. Like I say, an artist who is forever tied to the work of David Lynch. I think she kind of came of age with them on Blue Velvet, possibly, and then, you know, ended up working. That's her singing over like the signature theme tune to Twin Peaks and so much more. She would appear on the show over the years, a career in her own right, of course. She was a member of the B-52s. She toured with them throughout the 90s as a stand-in for Cindy Wilson. David Lynch was talking about her this week. Of course, he, you know, took to YouTube and just said that he only found out about the news about the great Julie Cruz passing away. Very sad news. Might be a good time to appreciate all the good music she made. Remember that as well as being a great musician, she was a great singer and a great human being. So yeah, just real quick, I didn't want the show to pass by without saying fucking rest in power, Julie Cruz. You were amazing. Yeah. Thank you for the music and the memories. And yeah, I'll always be obsessed with Twin Peaks. Hearing those musical notes always stops me in my tracks, and her vocals on the song Falling in line with that was absolutely amazing. But moving on, as we must, with the news section, we go from the sublime in terms of art and pop culture to the ridiculous. Joker 2. They're making Joker 2. Joker 2, now it's a musical, I guess. Mark, where do you stand on Todd Phillips and Joaquin Phoenix laugh-a-minute romp Joker from a few years ago?
Oh, that was a tough one. God, I was thinking about it today. Like that, I think I sort of knew that film was doomed from the start, but there was so much hype around it that I really wanted to believe that it was going to be absolutely exceptional, especially because Joaquin Phoenix has such a phenomenal hit rate and seems like a really good choice. And I think actually inhabited that character really well, but it wasn't his fault that the movie was such a train wreck in my eyes. It was just a mess, wasn't it?
People love it though.
Like, just incredibly on the nose. Like all the subtlety of a fucking explosion,
reversing dump truck without any tires on.
Yeah, it was just like the Joker holding a gun was just something that it just didn't feel right to me. Like, Joker is too sophisticated a villain to just whip out a gun and shoot someone in the head. Sorry for spoilers for a movie.
Spoilers for it made over $1 billion, which is inexplicable. He won the Oscar for Best Actor, and everyone was like, "It's like Taxi Driver, bro." And I'm like, "No, it wasn't." But whatever. We're not here to debate the merits of that. The point is, despite our best efforts, Mark, it's getting a sequel. It is happening. Mm. Todd Phillips has been teasing this. He put up a script on his Instagram with Joaquin Phoenix reading called Joker Folle Azur, which I think we can all agree that Folle Boy did that better. But the big news, apart from it being apparently a fucking musical, which I'm not actually against, but we'll get to that, is that reportedly the Hollywood Reporter had the story this week that Lady Gaga is in talks to play Harley Quinn. How do you feel about that and the fact that it could be a musical?
I'm stunned. The musical thing, I'm genuinely so intrigued by. Like, it seems like such an insane term. To be honest, if they do it, like, Joker is all about insanity and his world should feel kind of insane. So I'm kind of on board with that aspect of it. With Lady Gaga, no, I'm so done with Lady Gaga. Has she won an Oscar yet? Is this just Lady Gaga's, like, hunt for the Oscar?
It is, I would say so. She was nominated for A Star Is Born, did not win. She certainly tried to get nominated for House of Gucci with an endless press campaign for that, and she was not nominated, and rightly so, because I thought she was very good in A Star Is Born, but as good as she was in that movie, I thought she was horrendous in House of Gucci. So yeah, she's chasing this for sure. Yeah. And look, like, Lady Gaga, she's a super talent. She's actually, of course, sings the theme song to Top Gun Maverick, so it's all tying in here nicely.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I think she can obviously do a musical in her sleep. I think her being as part of the production can only help the production, because, like, She's got experience of that kind of thing, and I wouldn't trust Todd Phillips to tell me the fucking time, let alone put together a great musical. At the same time, though, I agree with you. The Joker's world is meant to be chaotic. Shouldn't your second movie be very different in that regard?
Yeah.
However, I just don't think that the material will be good enough. And the one thing I will say is I think it will piss off the fans who loved the first one. And I've already seen a lot of the comments being like, it's a fucking classic, leave it alone. Because they can't stand the idea of some kind of, you know, musical. What? No, not for me.
Yeah, yeah. I hope it's really camp. I hope it like totally rips up the rule book of like the dark superhero lore that sort of that Christopher Nolan sort of started and that we're so used to now. And I hope it's just like that episode, that musical episode of Scrubs, where it's just a good time song and dance, hour and a half.
With lots of violence, people getting shot in the face.
Yeah, lots more guns. I'm probably not gonna go see this.
I'll go see it because I am intrigued by the musical element. But yeah, I mean, didn't we say all we needed to say with an angry societal clown movie, the first one? Yeah. No?
It'd be nice to see Joaquin Phoenix singing and dancing again, though. I mean, after Walk the Line, it's been a while.
That was a bad movie. That was a TV movie. That sucked. I remember seeing that in cinema and being like, this is the most boring fucking movie.
Loved it. It's been a long time, though. It's been a long time.
Well, if Lady Gaga was to not end up doing this role, how about Phoebe Bridgers? Because she, of course, has been doing new interviews. She's touring at the moment. I believe she's due over here on Monday, possibly? Marley Park, maybe? Or is it one of those? St. Anne's, Fairview?
Fairview, I think, isn't it?
It's one of them, yeah. I don't know. I've lost, you know, my park knowledge is lacking, guys. Yeah. So,
brush up on your park life, Dave.
I will, yeah. She is due over. She has spoken about her new track, Sidelines, which is a contribution to the soundtrack of Conversations with Friends, Sally Rooney's latest TV jaunt, which is not getting anywhere near the buzz that normal people did.
An absolute clown show.
Which one?
Conversations with Friends.
Is it?
I watched the first two episodes, and oh my God, it was like watching paint dry.
Wait, didn't you have a song in Normal People? Am I wrong?
I mean, we don't need to go there.
Look at this man. I told you I was going to put you on the spot.
Lainey Abramson only directed one episode of Conversations with Friends.
Okay, all right, fine.
It's a different show, but it's very much trying to just recreate exactly what Normal People was. But it's almost like it's had all of the charm just like vacuum sucked out of it.
Well, Phoebe Bridgers has been talking up a storm about this new song, and she said that it, like, because people have said, like, it's a bit more upbeat. And she said, I'm striving to do more stuff like that. It's more challenging and to sound smart and to write well about happiness than it is about sadness. In the interest of not seeming trite, I lean toward darker subject matter just out of comfort. And I think a challenge to myself now is being articulate about things that are good. She disagrees with you, though. She said she really loved the Sally Rooney books and thinks that the lead character, Conversations with Friends, reflects her intimately. But, you know, we've already trashed the show. What do you think of the idea of Phoebe Bridgers making happy music and also the idea of an artist? And from your own point of view, I mean, like, you know, do you find yourself in a position where that is harder to write about being upbeat or to a different kind of emotion? Like, you know, like it's, we talk all the time about wanting people to come out of their comfort zone, but I think sometimes we also want the same but different, you know, quote unquote, from an artist. So what is what she's saying? Did it hit, does it resonate with you, this idea,
this difficulty in writing happy music
or any kind, or even just like going like in a full 180 direction?
I mean like an artist like Phoebe Bridgers, I mean she definitely has a style, and I do respect her for trying to sort of break out of the like the mopey midwestern emo vibe that she does so well. I'm very, very bad at writing happy songs. I'm very, like, any time I've ever done it, it's been a bit of a spectacular failure. I mean, it's a difficult thing to pull off, isn't it? Like, happy music is great, but it's often so nicely complemented by, like, deeply depressing lyrics, some of which we'll get into in the top five. I don't know. Pushing yourself out of your comfort zone, always a good thing. Fair play to her. Yeah, two thumbs up for me. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about here.
Well, who does? I mean, like, I mean, like, it's a tricky one because I don't think Phoebe Bridgers' music, I mean, yeah, it's known for being super emotional, and she's in that weird zone where obviously she attracts stans who want, you know, I want to cry at the Phoebe Bridgers gig, you know, so it's like the idea of some kind of like, you know, and now Float On by Phoebe Bridgers, you know, like I just don't know.
Well, I mean, she's ever since she started dating heartthrob Connell from Normal People, I mean, how could you not be happy? I expect
Paul Mescal, of course.
A Marvin Gaye style Let's Get It On record with nothing but a pair of O'Neill's shorts gracing the cover.
Well, I've said my throat got all dry there for a second. It's the cold it's I've had all week, everybody. I've got a horrible head cold. I've been fucking smothered this week, and I was convinced I'd reacquired COVID, but technically it should be too soon. I've been testing negative, but I've had a bad run. I would actually probably put it down to the fact that I went on a week-long holiday, two long-haul flights, boozing every single fucking night, came home, terrible jet lag, and then last week I got biblically rained on three times in the space of about 2 hours, so I was like, yeah, that'll probably do it. That'll probably set me down. But luckily, you know, we can just go listen to Phoebe Bridgers, you know, yeah, and have a good time.
Well, you look great.
Or, thanks, man. I feel terrible. I feel like a fucking warmed-up corpse. But, again, I mean, you know, maybe it's time to go for comfort zones. Like, you know, Muse, they used to be fun. Once upon a time.
Origin of Symmetry, absolute banger.
It is. It's a great record. Matt Bellamy, though, I think they have a new one coming. Sounds more like a threat than anything. He spoke to NME this week and said that society wants a new type of revolution. So, following the coronavirus pandemic, the war in Ukraine, and the current cost of living crisis, the frontman said he believes change is coming. I think everyone knows we want a revolution, but we definitely don't want a bunch of authoritarian lunatics from the right. That's the last thing we want, he told NME. And we don't want a total communist situation on the hard left either. I think what we want is something completely new. I don't think it exists out there at the moment, but there's new type of politics that could emerge. I would call it metacentrism. It's an oscillation between libertarian values for individuals, your social life, the ability to be whatever gender you are, all that kind of stuff, but then more socialist on things like land ownership, nature, energy distribution. It's the oscillation between the two poles. So rich man has ideas.
Good
is what I took from that, you know.
Stuff. Do you know, when I came out my front door this morning, there was a relatively sort of haggard looking man standing at my gate who
was a Matt Bellamy.
Well, this is what I'm wondering now, because he was asking me if I've checked the news and telling me that we're in big trouble and that in 2 weeks all the oil's going to be gone. And now it's just starting to sort of make sense now that this may well have been Matt Bellamy.
And were you like, I'm writing a thesis about the cinema, mate?
Yeah, leave me be, man. go on.
How did you defuse this situation?
He asked me in a gorgeous Limerick accent. He said, are you economically literate?
Was it blind boy?
who would know, man? Who would know?
I suppose, yeah. I've seen his face.
The bag was off. I mean, it's hard to know. But he asked me if I was economically literate, to which I replied defensively, yes, which I'm most absolutely not. And then just proceeded to say, well, and it actually genuinely got to me. He was like, have you checked the news? Oh my God, you won't believe it. And I was genuinely like, oh shit, what's happened? Like, am I going to open up my phone here and see like World War III or the greatest recession since the 1920s? But no, there was nothing. As he was walking away, he turned away and said one last thing. He goes, and if you're vaccinated, forget about it. Double trouble.
What the fuck?
So at this point, I was like, okay, maybe this guy isn't.
So you're meeting this guy for a pint after the recording here, are you?
Totally, we're going to listen to Drones by Muse.
Just two men setting the world to rights. I love it.
Exactly.
This Matt Bellamy interview is mental. Like, it's like, why are we asking Matt Bellamy about politics? I don't like it. But to be fair, maybe we do need a revolution. Maybe we need a musical revolution, much like punk in the 70s, or whatever it was. Sex Pistols. John Lydon has criticised his former Sex Pistols bandmate's new Danny Boyle show called Pistol, which has been on Disney Plus for a couple of weeks now. And by all accounts, right, I haven't seen it, But I haven't seen it. I've seen nothing but people say that this is a terrible program. Mm-hmm. Have you watched it?
No, no, I'd have no interest. I mean, yeah.
No. Apparently it's fucking awful. But yeah, so he's been warring against his former bandmates for quite some time and said, he said that the show is a middle-class fantasy that bears little resemblance to the truth. And he was greenlit without his consent. He wants nothing to do with it. I also desperately hope that he's not involved. Like the Sex Pistols, like a week ago, put up a tweet being like, we're doing an NFT. And it was like, really? The Sex Pistols are doing a fucking NFT? Okay, yeah. Good stuff.
For the Jubilee, Dave. here's the thing, right? Sex Pistols came out at a time, like, their rise to stardom was all captured on television. Like, those, like, it's legendary TV. All of the clips are there to watch on YouTube. And, like, say what you will about them as people or about their music, like, they were a thrill to watch. Like, when they were going on Bill Grundy and cursing and drinking cans and telling them where to shove it, like, it was thrilling television. So why do we need a remake of that? We've seen it. It's all there. It all exists. This just seems like how... I don't see a world in which it can be heightened, you know?
Yeah, I mean, listen, Mark makes a good point. They were, in fact, the Fontaines DC of their day. But John Lydon has said, having not watched the television show, he watched the trailer for the show. And he said to The Guardian, it's dead against everything that we once stood for. The only thing you've got of value in your life, you want to cheapen that because you want an extra fiver. Not much of a human being there. It's karaoke, the way we're talking, you know, it's all bollocks. So yeah, he's not into it whatsoever. But again, like I say, I think the world is on his side here. By all accounts, it's a bad show.
Yeah.
But he's doing stuff with Public Image Limited these days anyway, yeah, so he's doing fine.
Famous margarine advocate, John Lydon there. shockingly unhappy about something in the world. That just translates as he's not getting a big enough paycheck from this show.
That is usually how it goes. Yeah. But to Hollywood next, or maybe the independent world of the entire world of cinema, we don't know, for our top five. It is, of course, top five movie, opening, credits, music. I think that makes sense grammatically. It might not. I did stress over it, as I always do with these titles. Craig's better at the title than I am, to be fair. You'd miss him. I miss him. Mm-hmm. Come back, Craig.
I was thinking roll credits, but that kind of sounds like the end rather than the beginning, doesn't it?
It could work for both. So before we get to our top five, we didn't go best and worst. Now I think we're focusing on stuff that actually gives us the charge or provokes something within us, or in some cases in mine it's very much a case of, like, you know, you're going to watch a certain kind of movie. With my own top five, I will say, actually, you know what, fuck it, let's get in the mood here, let's set the tone properly. Adam, I prepared some music, if you could throw this as a bed or a clip, or maybe we'll talk over it. I don't know, hit it. I mean, it's outrageous. It's powerful. It's Harold Faltermeyer. It's the Top Gun theme, which appears in both Top Gun and Top Gun Maverick. That plays before Highway to the Danger Zone. Sorry, just listen to this nonsense.
Oh, so good.
It just makes you want to shoot down nameless countryless enemies in an F-18.
In nameless territories. Do you think that they took that out? Do you think they had a named enemy in that film and then they were just like, no, we can't?
Global box office, mate. We don't want to have... We don't identify anyone or offend anybody.
I honestly didn't feel the movie suffered at all not knowing...
No, sure, even in the first one, there isn't a direct counterpart to this guy.
Yeah.
You know, it's just... It kind of is what it is.
I was at the cinema with my dad and he just kept turning to me and nudging me and going, it's Russia. It's Russia, isn't it? It's definitely Russia. Your man, look at him. Big Russian head in him. Definitely Russia. That's Russia.
It did look Siberian, I will say, wherever they went to. But, you know, we won't spoil the movie anymore. The movie, because I was talking to a friend of the show, Richard Chambers. He went to see it and he was saying how, like, oh, the build-up, like, you know, like, there is a lot of repetition in that build-up, but, like, once it actually gets to the actual stuff at the end, it's fucking amazing. And I was like, yeah, I was like, it's like learning to beat a video game boss or something, like, you know, which worked perfectly for me. And like I say, I did go see it twice, because I went to see it in Toronto, And then when I was in Drogheda last weekend, I wanted to go see a movie with my brother and with my nephew, and there really wasn't that many options. And I was like, oh, fuck it, I'd go again. It's only been 10 days. Mm-hmm. And I kind of had a couple of things. So first of all, I went in, queued up, and the lady behind the counter in the cinema was like, I only have, like, you know, 3 rows from the front left. And I was like, yeah, whatever, I've fucking seen it, it's fine. So we went in, sat down, and it was grand. Like, it was a bit like, I don't know. But then as soon as the film began, right, and the credits rolled and, like, Tom Cruise walks on the screen, the fucking fire alarm went off in the screen. And of course, my brother turned to me and he was like, watch this, no one's gonna fucking move. And I went, yeah, I was like, Alan, I was like, some of these people have been waiting 33 years to see this film. But yeah, the fire alarm went off and I was like, oh man. And I was like, yeah, because the film is just too fucking rad, bro.
Too hot.
But too hot for cinema. I will say, any qualms I had about going to see it again quite quickly were quickly erased in a hail of jet engine flurry, because I was like, this film rules. I think it's great. Now, with this top five, what I did was I deliberately didn't... I picked stuff that was written for the film. So I didn't pick a song. Like, you know, I thought about, say, like, you know, Across 110th Street for Jackie Brown, but I wanted to just pick original music that was written for a movie and that's what it's there for, etc. Which isn't to suggest that the other way is wrong. There is no wrong way. I think if you... I didn't pick... I mean, like, maybe this is one of the ones that you're going to guess, but I didn't pick Trent Reznor and Karen O from The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is an amazing... amazing intro sequence, but I didn't pick that. So, yeah, I tried to be diverse in places.
I think you won't have picked my prediction then, if it's all original score work.
Well, let's wait and see. Yeah. Unless you want to, yeah, no, we'll get to that as we go. As for your strategy,
mentions at the end.
what was your strategy on this? Because you said you had fun doing it.
Yeah, I just went with my gut. Some of it was inspired by, like, I just went on, like, a family holiday to Kerry there for a couple of days. So some of it was inspired by just, like, dumb nostalgic watching that we did, like, at our, like rental gaff in Kerry. Some of it is just, like, all time great score music. Yeah, just like title sequences in particular, like some of it is just like how it artistically lends to like a nicely graphic, kind of well-realized title sequence. Yeah, we'll get into it.
Well, let's get into it. You're our honored guest, so I'll go for it. No. Actually, no. I think I will go first, though, because it means that you get to finish it. You get to have the end credits. Yeah.
The finish is a big one, so yeah.
See, there you go. Plus, I wanted to kind of set the tone here. Now, I've picked a problematic movie, but I think it's a great movie, and I think that this is one of the most... it's just such a pulse, it's such a charge, and I fucking love it. So here's my number five. Do you know what that is?
I have no idea what that is. No, not a clue.
Okay. That is, I believe it's called Who is Tyler Durden? It is the intro music to Fight Club from 1999 by the Dust Brothers, who composed an incredible soundtrack to that movie. Easy Mike and King Gizmo. They've been around since the 80s, but I must confess, outside of this, I don't really know a lot of what they've done. And they had a weird history with the Chemical Brothers, because apparently, like, the Dust Brothers name and trademark was used by the Chemical Brothers as a homage to them, but they wanted the Dust Brothers to sell them their name. That didn't happen, so they changed it to the Chemical Brothers. They eventually kind of reached some kind of understanding and they worked together. Like, I think Dust Brothers did a remix for them at some point. So they've had a very interesting career, and I don't quite know how prolific and active they've been in a mainstream sense. And, like, Fight Club is a major studio movie, but it was...
Did that Beastie Boys album, Paul's Boutique, which is...
Is that right?
Just, like, an outrageous amount of samples. Great record.
They're credited for some work on Imbop by Hansen. Surely that's a fake thing.
That sounds right. Yeah, because it has that like very sample heavy kind of like almost mashup production on it. Possibly did stuff with Beck.
Yeah, they worked on Midnight Vultures and Odelay.
There you go.
And Guero. Paul's Boutique. Yeah, yeah, it's all here.
Heavy hitters.
Heavy hitters. Heavy movie. Major studio movie. Was a flop, though. Kind of had its legs on VHS and DVD, I believe. Fight Club did. But the music in that movie is incredible. It sets such a tone. It's perfectly judged. I love it. I was obsessed with it. I was obsessed with the movie. I still think the movie's excellent. I know it has attracted a lot of controversy over the years. I maintain, from my point of view, that it's by people who misread the text of the film and unfortunately just thought it was some kind of bro, you know, alpha male dickhead fantasy. I always read to me as an absolute critique of that behavior and how stupid men can be. Granted, you know, you got Brad Pitt in 1999 going around looking like the coolest guy of all time, but I always took it as a satire, and I think it's a great, great film. And it annoys me to this day that people are like, oh, Fight Club, man, that's a red flag. I'm like, I think it's a great fucking movie, and I think it starts amazingly, obviously ends amazingly with Pixies and Where Is My Mind. Where do you stand on the motion picture Fight Club?
I think it's great. And yeah, I think it, like, I remember being a kid and like it being on TV late at night, like on RTE as like a midweek movie or something, and everyone in my school all of a sudden deciding that we were like totally misinterpreting the point of this movie, deciding that we were going to start a fight club. For 2 weeks, I just watched my friends kick the fucking lumps out of each other while I sat on the side, probably reading a Harry Potter book. but yeah, I always thought that it was a really smart like representation of like the crisis that happens in a society where like where people are just sort of neutered by their careers and by their mundane lives, and a really kind of interesting look at like that animal expression that like needs to come out when you sort of strip people of their souls. I always thought it was a great film. Yeah, loved it. Wasn't it also chosen by you for end credits?
It must have been, yeah. I'm probably making the same argument once again. But listen, as Mark says, we do, in fact, live in a society. What is your number five, sir?
famous Mark quote there. All right, let's let's go back to the society of the 1980s in good old-fashioned England.
Then you will get no hurt, mister. No, no, no. I said, yeah.
Okay, so that was Toots and the Maytals with 54.36. Oh my God, I'm definitely getting the number wrong. Was my number, as featured in Shane Meadows' incredible 2006 film, This Is England. Opening titles, obviously, as is the brief, depicts a kind of a montage of the UK at the time, the Thatcher era, Princess Diana and Prince Charles getting married, all the glamour of television and BBC and Top of the Pops, and then juxtaposes it up against the war in the Falklands, riots, the National Front, all sorts of crises and sort of like crises of the working class British citizens happening under the Thatcher government. Tees up the film just wonderfully in terms of creating that world, particularly because, you know, we then kind of get greeted with the opening scene of Lil Sean, whose father has passed away in the Falklands War. I love the song. It was my first introduction to Toots and the Maytals, and indeed this song, apparently written about the number that Toots himself was given when he was jailed for marijuana possession. So 54.36, that was his number. Yeah, have you seen This Is England, Dave? Have you heard this song before? Thoughts?
I have seen this film and heard the song. Yes, I saw this movie in the cinema when it came out in 2006. I think I saw it in the IFI or maybe the Screen, possibly even the Savoy. I can't remember, but it was definitely on my, you know, getting on a bus and going to Dublin to go see a cool new movie type situation. And I actually have never seen the film since because I found it to be such a heavy and harrowing and singular experience that I don't know if it would have the same effect on me a second time. And I should say as well, it closes with an incredible piece of music as well, a cover of Please, Please Let Me Get What I Want by The Smiths. Mm-hmm. It's a hell of a film. It's a boiling pressure cooker of a movie. And when it finally goes off, it's extremely difficult to watch, but in an incredibly artful and very respectful and brilliantly realized way. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think a song like this absolutely takes you into the time frame of it perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. Shane Meadows is great for soundtracks across pretty much all of his work, and the This Is England series that they've done throughout the years have had amazing features as well. And this song kind of perfectly does that thing, that Shane Meadows trick, where it sort of lures you into a false sense of security only to pull the fucking rug from underneath you maybe two-thirds of the way through the film. Yeah, that last 20 minutes or so is devastating and profoundly harrowing, but my God, like what a film, what a director, and what a lovable troupe of characters that he sort of weaves throughout it. So yeah, every time I hear that song, I think of this fantastic film and good old Maggie Thatcher.
Said ironically, of course. Wonderful actors though in the movie as well. Yeah, and again, a nice example as well of you know, even we talked about earlier on, but like, you know, pop music and, you know, like putting stuff, like this song is ostensibly like, I guess maybe like on a surface level, put you in a good mood, but, you know, tying it into that movie, which it does pull the rug in an incredible way. I never watched the TV shows. They did like a bunch of TV shows, of course.
They're so good. They're so good. Get on them. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think Shane Meadows, I've seen, he's done a couple of other films like A Room for Romeo Brass and...
Oh, he did Dead Man's Shoes, of course. Everyone loves. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think he's put a foot wrong thus far in my book. But never an easy watch when it comes to Shane Meadows. Like, definitely.
No.
Hits you where it hurts.
So, number four for me in the best movie opening credits music rundown. This one might cause some controversy. I think people will be like, what the fuck? But this film turned 10 years of age last week, I think it was. And it's a film that when I first saw it, I thought it was terrible. I thought it was absolutely awful. And I've gone from like one star on it to like four stars now. I've watched it a whole bunch over the preceding 10 years. It's still got a ton of problems. And even the music at first, I thought belonged in a completely different film. But now, it really transports me to an entirely different world. Adam, let's have it. So, that is... The track is called Life, and the film is called Prometheus.
Oh, never would have guessed that.
The composer is a German composer called Mark Streitenfeld, who has actually worked quite a bit with Ridley Scott. He worked on A Good Year, American Gangster, Body of Lies, Robin Hood, Prometheus, of course, as well. He's also worked on The Grey, which is a Liam Neeson film that I adore and deserves more love, in my opinion. Killing Them Softly, good movie as well. He had a hell of a run there from 2011 to 2014, or 2012, rather. So Prometheus, right. Yeah, it's a masterpiece, I think. Maybe, possibly, flawed as hell. It's got problems. Yes, I know she could have just ran left or right at the end of the movie. Why did she run in a straight line? All that kind of jazz. But I find myself going back to this movie and I find myself just being like, I love this. Mm-hmm. I adore the first hour. I would agree that the problems mount once it kicks off a bit. But I don't know. There's something about it, man. And I find myself watching the... the 3.5 hour accompanying documentary, which is called Furious Gods, which I would recommend everyone go and see. It's brilliant. Yeah. Breaks down into all kinds of different methods of, you know, casting and practical effects and music and visuals and blah, 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 blah. And it's great. It's like a filmmaker's toolbook, you know, like or toolkit rather. Yeah, look, it's a film that I completely understand why people would be like, no, it sucks. It has no redeeming features whatsoever. But I am a sucker for sci-fi. I love how this film looks. Mm-hmm. I love the feeling I have, particularly in that first hour. Mm-hmm. And I do think that Mark Straightenfeld's music goes an awful long way. And I love the motif in this. Even like I said, though, when I first saw this, I was very much like, this feels like a Superman theme. This feels like it should be in something more hopeful. It really clashed with me. I really couldn't marry it at all. But now, having seen the film a bunch of fucking times, I think it's such an important part of it. And I love it. I love the movie.
Nice.
Flaws, of which there are many and all.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to have to go watch Prometheus again. I haven't seen it since it was in the cinema, but not being very familiar with the lore of the Alien universe, I just watching it just as a standalone movie, I really enjoyed it. Particularly that first half, it was very, very intriguing premise and asked some pretty big questions about mankind and where we come from, and
it may not answer those questions particularly satisfactorily, but it tries. And I will say, Michael Fassbender, never better for me. Amazing.
Yeah, Robo Fassbender. Nice, nice choice. Nice choice. Okay, let's tee up. Let's go back to 2004 to another trip to Dublin cinema, venturing in from Wicklow to something that would rock my world.
Hear the yell, back to school, ring the bell, brand new shoes, walking blues, climb the fence, books and pens, I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
Yeah, so that is The White Stripes with We Are Gonna Be Friends from the title sequence of Napoleon Dynamite. A film that I knew absolutely nothing about when I wandered into town in 2004 to see it with my mates. I don't think I'd even seen a trailer. I was totally, right from roll credits here at the beginning, totally just engrossed, confused, perplexed, enamored. What is this world that they've created? When is this set? Who is this person? Who are these characters? Why does everything look horrible? Why is there so much food? Why does that liger look like that? Who drew that? I mean, I think like Napoleon Dynamite is a film that was sort of maybe pastiched and copied a lot and sort of ushered in this sort of like ironic, like sort of retro nostalgic sort of weird culture of just like borrowing things from different eras and sort of stapling them together. But at the time, I'd never seen anything like this, and I was just totally enamored right from this moment where the white stripes pop up. If anyone can't remember the title sequence, it's basically just plates of food being served on a carpet. It's like tater tots and nachos and like lasagnas and things like that. And like there's like the titles of the cast and the producers and the director and so forth, they're all just spelled out with what's known in the biz as environmental typography. So it's just ketchup and mayonnaise and mustard and, you know, sauces spelling out these names. Became a big trend in the design world for a long time after that as well. I love it. Makes me feel very warm. Makes me feel whole, makes me feel complete. Definitely need to go back and revisit the film, although I am afraid that it will not have lasted in the way that that it won't have now the staying power that it had back then.
So this film, right, what you were describing there, I think in many ways this is an example of something that was like a meme before we were using the word meme in every other sentence, you know, predates social media and YouTube, etc. But like, I know what you mean, because it felt that way. It felt like this kind of weird thing that I had already consumed by osmosis, to the point where, man, and this might upset you, I haven't seen this film because I can't bring myself to see the film because I feel like I missed the moment. I missed the organic moment with this movie.
Yeah,
Adam's and I've seen face. The dance scene. Adam's not happy. Mark's not happy, guys. They're not pleased.
It's not like, happy. I'm just a bit more shocked than anything else, if I'm being honest.
I just, something about it just didn't appeal. Like I was just like, I just don't, this will be for me. And again, I just think that I caught it at the wrong time, or I could have caught it at the wrong time or something. So, but what you're telling me is I am missing out, right?
Yeah, it was definitely a sea change moment in terms of, like, it almost ushered in the internet. And I don't think it knowingly did so, but absolutely, I mean, it's just like a million quotes, like the vote for Pedro thing was everywhere. I can totally understand why, you know, I was like that with Anchorman for a long time. Like, I just could not go near Anchorman because everywhere you went, people were saying, I love Lamp. And it was just this, like, just this ubiquitous, annoying meme of a thing that you couldn't escape. Another great film, but again, yeah, it's like moments like these are like lightning in a bottle, and they do get picked up and like parodied and pastiched and referenced to bits. So I always think back to that day sitting in like Cineworld on Parnell Street and just having no idea what I was about to experience, and the feeling of like awe and wonder at not knowing what the hell I was experiencing. And that's kind of that's the Napoleon Dynamite that I like to remember.
But that's a lovely thing, though. And that's one of the things that I've always loved about going to movies and going to the cinema, and the cinema experience when it's not ruined for whatever reason by outside interference, when you do genuinely go somewhere else. And I fucking adore it. Mm-hmm. So for this, though, we're going back to a different era. Dave's favorite era, the mid-90s, the VHS era. And this intro, which, and I have audio, like, I have like audio from the movie as well as this starts up, as the credits are hitting the screen. This is peak 90s, and I think that it tells you that in this construction. Adam, please.
Congressman Weaver and esteemed members of the Special Armed Services Committee, I come before you to protest a grave injustice. I love that. I don't know whether you edit these down for the actual podcast or not, but I love that Dave's clips are like 2 minutes long a piece.
Now, in fairness, I think we're going to try and test the waters here on this one, but we'll see what happens. Adam will make the call, but I deliberately made them longer because I'm trying to get into the groove of an opening credit stretch, etc. So I think you kind of need it.
I'm here for it.
And we did the same with closers as well.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, Dave, you did actually pick Pixies Where's My Mind from Fight Club.
Of course
for that
I did. Of course
well.
I did. Well remembered.
And yeah, it's yeah, we did the same thing. I think it's worth like having the lengthy clip in there.
If Buena Vista Pictures want to come at me for using, can you guess what this is? Did you know what
it's
was?
The Buena Vista Social Club, isn't it?
No, it's not. It's 1996, fourth highest grossing film of 1996. It's Michael Bay's The Rock.
Oh.
It is the opening scene to The Rock, and the track is called Hummel Gets the Rockets. So,
is that Ed Harris in there?
It's Ed Harris. Ed Harris is playing the character of Brigadier General Francis X. Hummel of the USMC Force Recon. And the plot of this movie, if you don't know it, is Harris's character. And like the opening stretch there, it's lashing rain. He's in his suit. He's going to the graveside of his wife. People are saluting him. He's like, he's suiting up, and he's basically saying like he's done something that he has to do. And what he's done is he's stolen nuclear weapons, and he's trying to get like, you know, I think it's like money and honor for like men who were killed in a mission or something, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, Nicolas Cage and Sean Connery have to stop him, damn it. But he's an interesting character. He's a good villain because he's an interesting villain. He's got like a moral compass, but he's doing this crazy thing. But the music by Hans Zimmer is one of them, and Nick Glennie Smith. There was also, I think, Harry Gregson-Williams and other musicians worked on this as well. From the off, like, I mean, you know, in that moment, you're watching a fucking movie. You're like, I'm sitting down. this is a fucking movie, everybody, and you're watching a movie.
Big,
it's very much as like, we're going to take you somewhere. We're going to take you in this ridiculous, stupid action movie. Now, I've seen this movie fucking a million times. Like, you know, it's one of the great 90s action movies, and the kind of the league table pantheon of like Terminator 2, Broken Arrow, Face Off, Con Air, this, obviously, several others. And I remember I did rewatch it a while ago, and I remember being not as impressed as I was when I was younger. But I don't know, listening to that music now and hearing that opening sequence makes me just want to watch it all over again. Now, there is a man, of course, who recently joined Letterboxd, the film website that we log our movies on, purely to talk about action movies. So, Adam Shanahan.
This, I haven't darkened the door of this one yet, but I feel like this could be tonight's edition. I remember this being like such a good flick back in the day. But aside from that, that's not what I wanted to throw my two cents in about. So myself and Craig have often wondered about what the count is on certain like people getting into the top five.
Oh, Hans Zimmer.
I'd say Hans Zimmer's on 20 plus at this point.
Well, the thing about Hans Zimmer here is like, I mean, like this is also, he's such a fucking cannibal of himself. Like, you know, and so is Trent Reznor. So it's fine. You can't like hold it too hard against them. But like Hans Zimmer is continually recycling his stuff. I think in those kind of like big kind of epic march sweeps there and the rhythm kicking in, you can hear his upcoming Pirates of the Caribbean score there, right? Just like the kind of, and the more this one goes on, there's so much like, like it's all that kind of stuff. And that's what The Rock is for 2.5 hours. It's a ridiculous film.
That's so on the ball. It's very pirates.
Yeah, I kind of want to watch it tonight. I kind of want to watch Fight Club tonight. I don't know what to do, but I'll move on for now and let Mark take the microphone.
Unreal. Okay, well, look, let's... on the subject of Pirates of the Caribbean, leads me to think of Johnny Depp. Let's keep it on the theme of problematic humdingers.
Oh, no. Where are you going?
Number three. It's not, as Adam suggested, an iPhone ringtone. It is, in fact, the theme from American Beauty by Thomas Newman. That's actually called Dead Already. Not the theme from American Beauty, but the opening track used in an amazing sequence where we get introduced to Kevin Spacey's character at a time when I adored the man with every fiber of my being.
Oh no.
He could do no wrong in 1999.
Little did we know.
I'd say he probably did a lot wrong in
my mind. he was just a misunderstood father jerking off in the shower. So Thomas Newman, I think, it holds the...
Sorry, I feel like I should step in. That's a reference to the movie, just in case anyone hasn't seen American Beauty. Like, just to be clear,
did,
like, okay?
I did have a moment.
It's the opening scene of the film.
Opening scene of the film.
I had a moment there myself where I was like, if people don't know.
No, I'm talking about the film.
I hate killing jokes, but sometimes you just gotta provide the context.
Keeping me out of trouble.
It makes more sense, actually. I like it better now that we did explain this.
The world's gone politically correct now, guys.
Can't say anything on a podcast anymore. It's the highlight of his day, if I recall correctly.
He said a great line at the beginning of that film where he's kind of narrating his morning and he's like, "This is me jerking off in the shower," and it's a very kind of sad, sort of pathetic angle of him shot from outside the camera, and he's just like, "This will be the highlight of my day. It's all downhill from here." It's a wonderful, wonderful opening monologue from what I think is a fantastic film. It's been a long time since I've watched it. It's kind of hard to watch Kevin Spacey now, knowing what we know. But this soundtrack, man, oh my God, I've absolutely worn it out over the years. I think Thomas Newman is really underrated in terms of, like, he's in the conversation, but I don't hear his name thrown around as much as, say, a Hans Zimmer or a John Williams. I think he's, like, every bit as talented as both of them, if not even better. He's done work for The Shawshank Redemption. He's done Finding Nemo, which has a gorgeous score. And in American Beauty, what I love about it is just how sort of unconventional it is for, like, essentially like a kind of a subversive sort of kitchen sink suburban American drama. We've got like all these African kind of percussion sounds going on, and all sorts of like pitched percussion in the form of like marimbas and xylophones. And there's just this like sort of playful mystery and tension and this like seductive danger to it. It's also got like the iconic plastic bag theme, which I think of every time I see a plastic bag blowing through the wind. I just think front to back, this soundtrack is absolutely stunning. I listen to it a lot, like outside of the film. I used to listen to it a lot when I was on tour, and it would put me to sleep, and then there would just be a wild sort of like African percussion madness bit that would wake me up. But yeah, I love it. I love it to bits. And maybe I'll chance the film again.
Wow, brave move. I will say, sorry, if you heard any environmental storytelling of my own there, I had to get up and close my window because as hot as this room is and it's fucking boiling, it's very loud outside.
So I was like, across the road filming as well. Make sure you pull the curtains.
Missed your hand ready? No. So I had a look at Thomas Newman's Wikipedia there. He has been working steadily since the 80s. Like, I mean, this guy has like one or two films a year that he works on, including stuff like Spectre, Skyfall, Bridge of Spies in recent years. He's a man in demand. Someone who... And now, when those first notes started playing, I was like, what a choice. Because I remember, again, saw this in the cinema, thought it was great. Haven't revisited it in a long time. To be fair, this isn't me like taking some moral high ground stance. I'm a hypocrite. I did watch LA Confidential recently. I watched The Usual Suspects recently. I watched The Negotiator, an absolute trash fire of an entertainingly bad good movie from the 90s that he's also in. So yeah, it's not about that. Although, you know, obviously a terrible human being. Hope he goes to prison. But the music in this movie fucking rules. Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous. And it feels very Royal Yellow to me as well with regards to, you know, that kind of world, you know, like bringing in all kinds of different influences from across the globe.
I'll take it.
So yeah.
I'll take it. Yeah, love it, love it. Gonna go listen to it tonight, I think.
We're all gonna have very big evenings by the sounds of things. And in the meantime, we'll press on with my runner-up. I kind of struggled on this one. Like, you know, I kind of had some obvious Dave picks, and then in the end, I was like, no, go for this one. And I actually picked for No Oxcord recently. Our Patreon show, which you can get at patreon.com/noencore. It's a recent release, but the score of this film has stayed with me since I saw the film. I think it's an excellent score to work to listen to drift away to. And I think it's unfurled beautifully in this film over the opening credits. So here we go. Number two. So that is Eiko Ishibashi. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong. I'm probably mangling this name completely. A Japanese singer, songwriter, and musician. And the track is Drive My Car from the film Drive My Car, which came out a few months ago over here on this side of the world and came out in 2021 elsewhere. Have you seen this film?
No, I started watching it through illicit means online, and then the subtitle that was embedded got all messed up, and I was only getting like one side of a conversation, so I paused it. But I'm very much looking forward to going back.
You can watch it via legal means now. It's on Mubi, the art house streaming platform.
Nice.
It's a gorgeous, gorgeous film, and it does that trick that some people don't like because it's a bit of a trick, but I kind of like it when it's done well enough, and it's done well in this movie. It's a bit of a spoiler, but I'm going to say it anyway. The opening credits don't happen until half an hour in, which I think is just...
Whoa.
What a flex. Like, it's outrageous. Wow. You had a half an hour of storytelling and a ton of inciting incidents, and all of a sudden, like, there's this long shot of a car driving down a motorway, and then it comes up, like, this starts playing, and then it comes up, like, you know, a film by, and I'm like, oh my god. Yeah, huge move.
Yeah.
A beautiful film about love and loss and grief, and the music, the whole soundtrack is like this. It's just, I don't have the education to talk about the sophistication of how the soundtrack is put together. And it wouldn't necessarily be my go-to style of music. I mean, there's lots of jazz rhythms in here. I know fucking nothing about jazz. I'm beyond ignorant when it comes to it. I have such a lack of appreciation for complex music. You know me, I like nu metal. But the thing is, I adore this score. I think it's fucking amazing. I've been listening to it on repeat in the months since I saw the film. It's a short enough score as well. The film is about 3 hours long, but the score, I think, is only a little bit over 30 minutes, if I have that correctly. It's just beautiful. It's such a cliche alert, but it's such a character in its own right. It elevates and supports this film so gracefully, and it's such a graceful film. I loved it. I thought it was stunning. It is long, it is languid, and it is very, very heavy without really saying a lot at times. You got to be patient with it, but I genuinely can't wait to see it again. I'm kind of biding my time, even though I said I can't wait there. But it's one of the films of the year. The music is so, so perfect, and I just loved that moment, and I loved sitting there in the cinema with Higgs, and just like when that happened, I was like, oh my God, man, this is unbelievable. I was like, what a flex.
Nice.
What an art house flex. So all yeah, right, drive my car. Please, everyone, check it out.
I can't wait to see it. I thought your Letterboxd review of it was very thoughtful and very moving as well. So
thanks, man. Yeah.
Reason to go and check it out.
Thank you. Yeah. I will say it was very, very difficult not to sit there in that movie after, you know, losing my father and just, you know, not have that kind of circle through my brain. But the film, honestly, like, despite the fact that, you know, it could have broken me, I felt like the film gave me a big warm hug. So beautiful. That's kind of what I took beautiful. From it. So
I love when that happens, when things come along just when you need them. When you're in bits.
As I so often am.
Now, to pivot to something... You said you don't know much about jazz, Dave. Well, maybe after this.
I thought you were going to do Marty McFly. Well, listen to this.
This is a complete change of gear. Again, from Summertime. Oh, my second in a row from 1999, Summertime for Humanity. This one where I've left a little bit of dialogue in. This is one that we watched in Kerry as a family last week when I was hanging out with my dad. Let's go.
I can't believe Vanessa, my bride. My one true love, the woman who taught me the beauty of monogamy, was a fembot all along. Wait a tick. That means I'm single again. Oh, behave! Yeah! Yeah, baby, yeah!
Yeah, baby. Oh, behave. That is the unmistakable sound of Austin Powers 2, The Spy Who Shagged Me, with a theme that I had no idea was actually not an original theme composed for the film, but actually an original composition by none other than Quincy Jones.
Of course.
1962 album, Big Band Bossa Nova. I was shocked.
No, sorry. Can I just step in here and say that you set this up with like this perfect idyllic family situation? I was like, oh, what warm classic did they watch together? What could it possibly be? Amazing.
Oh,
what a rug
pull. You have not met my father. yeah, so my dad, who introduced me to Leslie Nielsen and
amazing.
Who took me to the cinema to see Shame on my first viewing of that film. That was an experience.
The Michael Fassbender sex movie.
Still processing with my counselor. Yeah, I grew up in a very open, free household. Yeah, nothing was taboo. Certainly not Austin Powers 2 or Shame, although some things we wish were. But yeah, anyway, this is a ridiculous film, obviously. I was nervous about picking it. I almost picked this theme as my number one, but was like, I don't know. There are definitely problematic aspects to this film. I don't want to come under that much heat. But I do think for the most part, Mike Myers has created a film here that represents a simpler time, a cheekier time, a sexier time, a fun time. Yeah, I don't know. It's nostalgia. It's ridiculous. Like taking the James Bond sort of meta narrative and like just flipping it on its head to just be this gross, sexed up, cheeky maniac. I don't know. I love it. I don't know what's wrong with me, but this theme since selecting it a couple of days ago for the top five, I have not been able to stop listening to it. Apparently it's been used in like 20 different TV shows. It's like, you know, it's had a good run since 1962. So that makes it, oh my God, like, does that make it 60 years old?
Yes, it does.
Holy moly. So Quincy was a young man putting this together, apparently composed it in like 20 minutes. It's just irresistible, right? Like, it's just like when I leave this world and my coffin is carried out of the chapel, I just want this. I just want this on.
Everyone's going to start dancing.
Everyone just swinging. You know? It's amazing. In the title sequence in question, Austin Powers, of course, loses his brand new bride to her being a fembot who malfunctions and explodes in his hotel, in his honeymoon suite. And then he proceeds to saunter about the hotel butt naked, with his genitalia continuously being covered by baguettes and like funny hats and like babies shakers.
There's a teapot at one stage, I think, isn't there? Like, yeah,
there's like two rabbis cutting a big piece of salami, and like, it's just ridiculous. It's pure like Leslie Nielsen Naked Gun style.
Yeah, yeah.
Buffoonery, and I can sanction this buffoonery. I love it. Yeah, I'm ultimately an 11-year-old boy still at heart, and this just gets me every time.
That is a phenomenal, phenomenal choice. A very unexpected one, I will say, but inspired nonetheless. Number one for me, back to Dave's favourite decade, the 90s, and back for more epic, epic, epic stuff. I contemplated getting something in from this director, and it was like, well, what one will it be? And I think it's going to be this one, because I think the music in this movie is such an important part of it. And I think it's a great film. I think that it's oddly underrated, and this is how it starts. So that is the opening title theme from The Last of the Mohicans from 1992, which means that, it's turning 30 in August or September, I believe. Michael Mann film. The music is composed by Trevor Jones and Randy Edelman. The main theme that you heard there, which is used once again as part of the film's kind of overall signature and one that plays over the end, the exceptional ending sequence of this movie, which is a song called Promontory or Promontory. They sample The Gale, which is an old country folk song, I believe, by a Scottish musician called Dougie MacLean. Clonid are on the soundtrack, by the way. It's just unbelievable. And again, it's like you're sitting there, the screen is black, this is building, it crashes in, the name of the fucking movie burned onto the screen, and you're like, yeah, okay, I know I'm about to watch something huge here. This is like a two-hour film that feels about 6 hours long, and not in a bad way. Have you seen The Last of the Mohicans?
I have not.
Shocking. Have not. Get off my podcast.
I need to see it. There's a very romantic story, actually. A guy that I'm doing the MA with, it's his girlfriend's favourite film.
Oh, wow.
And for her birthday, he created like a video player. Like, he like built it from like a Kindle or something and programmed it to play The Last of the Mohicans at like one frame every 3 hours. So like, basically, because it's her favorite film, the idea was that like, if he plays it at one frame every 3 hours, it will last 20 years or something.
This is ridiculous. So oh my God.
So for the next 20 years, she's going to be watching Last of the Mohicans. I think that's very sweet.
That is exceptional. This man is going to have the best wedding of all time.
Dempsey. Yeah, I mean, but she's going to be like shooting in for like the ending when they're on their wedding. But hang on. Shout out to Sean Dempsey. You absolute sweetheart, you.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's genuinely amazing. My God, no sound, that's love.
Though, unfortunately. Imagine what this soundtrack would sound like stretched out, like one of those YouTube videos where it's like 10,000 times slower.
Yeah, I do love those. Justin Bieber, 800 times slower. Okay. Like it is, yeah, genuinely euphoric. You do need the music, though. You need the sound in this movie. So this is a film in which Daniel Day-Lewis is in, of course. He's great in this movie. It's set during the French and Indian War. Wes Studi, who is an incredible Native American actor, plays the villain Magua, and it's one of the great villain performances you'll ever see. There's a ridiculous scene in which Daniel Day-Lewis and Madeline Stowe, who have fallen in love with each other, are like, you know, being separated, and there's a waterfall, and Daniel Day-Lewis is there looking un-fucking believable, by the way, with his long hair.
I believe it.
The full-on Mills and Boone guy come to life, you know, and he's there, and it's like, you know, stay alive, you know, I will find you, and it's just ridiculous, like, it's just like bodice ripping, yeah, it's crazy, but like, it's an amazing film, it's brilliant, I love it, and the last fucking 10 minutes, man, I could watch the last 10 minutes of this movie on loop, and I did put it on last night after I was putting this together, and I was just like, in awe of what I was seeing. Michael fucking Mann, everybody.
Michael Mann, every now and again, he really pulls it out of the bag, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's kind of tipped off a bit in recent years, but nonetheless. But the music of this movie, seriously, Trevor Jones, Randy Edelman, Dougie McLean, everyone involved,
amazing.
He knocked it out of the park. Go watch this fucking movie, it's great.
This is great, I'm getting a proper like to-do list out of this episode. Here's a movie for my number one that should not be on anyone's to-do list, in that everyone has seen this film. It is an obvious choice. It was the first one that came to mind when we thought of the top five. I couldn't not pick it. It is absolutely magnificent. And yeah, see for yourself. Here it goes. Oh yeah, the circle of life. That is.
Oh, keep going.
That is Elton John and Tim Rice's Circle of Life from 1994's masterpiece, The Lion King, with vocals from Carmen Twelly and Libohang Moraki. Apologies, I've probably pronounced those names wrong. Just an incredible, incredible tune. So good, in fact, that when they remade The Lion King in recent years, a film that looked like it was an absolute disaster.
Yeah, please tell me you didn't watch that.
I didn't go to see it, but I was looking at the soundtrack today, and sure enough, track one is just a copy and paste, like facsimile carbon copy of this. So at least they had the decency to keep it intact for the remake. Not that that remake ever needed to happen. Yeah, a masterpiece. Elton John, I mean, no stranger to writing absolute belters. This could be a career highlight. Big Elton.
Big Elton.
I don't know. It moves me to goosebumps every single time I watch it. It is the boldest, biggest, most ridiculously epic opening sequence of all time. I was at a festival a couple of years ago where a cover band played it, and it was like the Sunday of a festival, and everyone's kind of hung over and everyone's kind of sitting on the grass and sort of like trying to piece their brain back together. And there was a father there carrying like his like very young child, like probably only a couple of weeks old, this baby. And he was the first to sort of stand up, and he just approached the stage, stood in front of the stage, and when it hit that bit, just lifted his newborn child in front of a festival audience who were just rising to their feet, antlers in the air, like just going off. It was a magical moment.
I don't know, man. I mean, I was going to ask you, does stuff like that not, like, did this not get buried in the world of parody and stuff like that? I mean, like, that just sets all my fucking cringe bones on fire at the same time. When I'm like, some guy lifting his fucking kid up.
Like, you know, when you're at a festival, like, all critical facilities are kind of shut down, especially.
Have you met me? You know what I do at
yeah,
festivals.
Sorry, maybe not so. You. When. When fun people are at festivals, Dave, they like to switch the brain off. And it was just one of those moments where you're totally brain dead. Like, you're still probably half pissed from the night before, and you're just like trying to sort of find the strength to go on. And moments like that, I think, yeah, they have their place in festival culture, Dave.
All right.
But yeah, I don't know.
Well, like Native American headdresses on white people as well. Yeah, that kind of festival culture.
Not
is that one?
Quite. No. I wouldn't be as big a fan of that. But tell me, Dave, what's your opinion on The Lion King? Were you a fan? Did you see the remake? What's your stance?
Loved the original as a boy. Haven't had much of a desire to explore it again as an adult. And I think in the shootout of classic Disney's, Aladdin wins every time for me.
Oh, man. Can I tell you an Aladdin one?
Of course.
I sang A Whole New World on RTE television in 1995.
Excuse me?
Yeah, with my then 5-year-old girlfriend at the time. On a poor substitute for The Den, because The Den used to go on summer break. so they had this, like, it was called Jump Around. It was hosted by Joe Rooney of Father Damo fame. And it was a similar kind of format, like a puppet and a wisecracking host. And they'd like have kids on, and the kids would like sing songs from movies that they loved. Myself and my girlfriend, I can't believe I had a girlfriend when
You're
I was five. My girlfriend,
my
Ruth, at the time, went on, sang A Whole New World. I carried Ruth all the way. I still have the footage. Adam is like spitting his water onto his keyboard.
That was very ill-timed, Marco.
My God, gentlemen.
Yeah, no, maybe we'll cut that bit out.
No, we will not.
Yeah,
absolutely not. No way. Best of 2022, baby. Straight in there.
Yeah, so yeah, another absolute humdinger. And if it had been in the opening of that film, perhaps it would have replaced all else.
So you nailed it. This is what I'm hearing. You fucking nailed it.
No, it's horrifically embarrassing. My mum still has the VHS. it's me like nipples out, belly button out in like an Aladdin, a little purple waist jacket.
So same as your Primavera last week then?
Pretty much, yeah. Just, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, the Indian headdress.
Yeah, Aladdin. I love Aladdin. I haven't seen the remake of that. I haven't seen the remake of The Lion King. I hate this soulless bullshit. Oh, they're photorealistic now. Cool. Mm. They can't show emotion. Good stuff. Mm. That's the whole point of these movies. And in the battle of modern day Pixar stuff, Monsters, Inc. wins every time for me over everything else, just for the record here. But no, you made a convincing case. I did not see that coming. I did not see Austin Powers coming. This has been a wild ride. What a top five it's been. My God.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, I decided to leave all cool at the door, but I was very impressed by your selects, Dave. I think you kept it nicely balanced.
They're very Dave selections, in fairness. So we go from opening credits to end credits now as we pull the shutters down on this week's episode. And of course, we pay tribute to our grand auteur, our great director, sonic architect Adam Shanahan. And, I mean, could I ask for a better supporting actor this week than Royal Yellow Mark O'Brien? I don't think I could. Thank you so much for coming back to us, man.
Dave, I fear I've said many things that I will regret. But
no, it was all
for a good podcast episode. Then I don't know what is.
It was all gold, and another form of gold is, of course, yellow. Please go check out Royal Yellow on all good streaming platforms right now, and we look forward to seeing what you do in the future.
Thanks,
please,
guys.
Please tell me that like this thesis of yours, when it's finally done, will be available for a public consumption.
Sure,
because
I desperately
want to see it. Like,
totally, man. I will absolutely send it on. I look forward to getting your 2 cents on it.
You can have more than 2 cents. You can have the whole damn bag of coins. Next week on No Encore, we look forward to welcoming back Craig Fitzpatrick, happy and healthy, I hope. Best wishes to Craig, as he said to me earlier on that he's at about 60%. He said tested negative, so I've gone from lying vacantly in my bed to lying vacantly on the grass. So that's Craig for you.
Still thinking about the Strokes.
Oh, I'm sure.
Sitting under a tree somewhere.
Imagine like a thought bubble coming out of his head of just shooting Casablancas. Apparently they were terrible at Primavera on weekend too. So,
great.
From what I heard.
Oh, that makes me feel better.
Oh no, yeah. I saw a video from someone and she put up a caption saying, not the Strokes, earning their reputation as one of the worst live bands out there. Jesus Christ. And I was like, ah, come on, they were good at Picnic. So I hit the audio on it and I was like, that does sound kind of bad. And then I was talking to a colleague today who was there and she was like, yeah, they were terrible. She was Julian Casablancas does not want to be there. So,
Ouch. Oh, God. Well, maybe they get a pass for, you know, being on the COVID, you know, being on the back of COVID. I certainly wouldn't want to get up and do a gig in the state that I was in.
Yeah, fair enough. Post-COVID. And on that note, everybody, go check out all the movie music that we talked about. Go check out all the music that we talked about. And we will be back next week. I believe, Adam, am I right in saying that Craig and I haven't done a show together for like a month now at this stage?
Yeah, it's been a while, as Craig would say.
And to play us out, Stained. My name is Dave Hanratty. This has been No Encore. There will be No Encore. Bye-bye. Back next week. See you. Bye.
It's been a while since I could hold my head up high, and it's been a while since I first saw you.